Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and if you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please go to our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter, at Irish History Pod, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. My co-presenter, John Dorney, recently organised a series of lectures in the Teachers Club in Dublin for the People's College on the theme of Ireland's revolutionary experience of 1916 to 1923 in a world context. Here is Brian Hanley's lecture, Irish Labour After 1916.
I was originally asked to speak about Labour after 1916, and I saw then today on Facebook that I was speaking about whether or not a revolution was possible. It's a very, very broad subject, as you can imagine, and I want to try and address issues such as the 1918 election, the democratic programme and Labour's attitude towards the treaty, and give an account of what was happening across the country in terms of Labour in its broadest sense. Now, I also apologise that I have a chest infection at the moment, and there's every chance that I'll at some point collapse, probably, hopefully not collapse, but certainly start coughing. So again, I'm apologising in advance for that. Anybody who's speaking about this area of history, and John's been very generous, but the fact is that anybody who talks about Irish Labour history owes a debt to a whole range of people, some of whom are here tonight, who've written on the diversity and extent of working class activity in that period of Irish history. And that's very much, in many ways, in contrast to the dominant view of Irish historiography, which has really too easily accepted Kevin O'Higgins' rather self-serving assertion that he and his colleagues were the most conservative-minded revolutionaries to ever put through a successful revolution. And O'Higgins may well have been correct about himself, but Irish society in those years saw intense upheaval and certainly plenty of class conflict. So that's not the whole story, although I will talk about the Republican movement at various stages as well. I'm anxious as well not to give in to the temptation of the single transferable speech, but anybody who's heard me speak has probably heard me quote Ernie O'Malley before. I'm going to quote him again, and this is from On Another Man's Wound, and O'Malley was reflecting on Irish society in the early 20th century, and he said, "In the towns, tuppence halfpenny looked down on tuppence, and throughout the country the grades in social difference were as numerous as the layers of an onion." And I think that's a useful kind of analogy, because Irish people were acutely and minutely aware of class distinctions, both within and between classes. And when we discuss Labour, I think we need to be aware that the trade union movement, let alone the left, and of course there are various elements on the left at the time as well, which I'm not really going to talk about in too much detail, are not the same thing as the working class. And that class is made up of numerous elements, sometimes united, more often divided. In Ireland, there was a very obvious division in this period between a very powerful industrial working class in North East Ulster and the rest of the country. And the split between unionism and nationalism divided Labour of all types. The Ulster Teachers Union, for example, was established in 1919 as a breakaway from the Irish National Teachers Organisation because the INTO supported the anti-conscription strike and protest campaign in 1918. So we can't avoid the consequences of those divisions, or indeed partition itself. But you also then have marked differences between the skilled and the unskilled, between men and women, and also concepts such as respectability. And that sometimes influences how people view class and their relationship to it. Again, people who've written on the history of white-collar workers have often noted that it wasn't necessarily how much somebody was paid that, you know, made them very aware of their difference with the unskilled, but the fact that they saw themselves as very, very different to the unskilled in a whole range of ways, even the way that they dressed. And that certainly was a factor in Labour as well. But the general picture after 1916 for Labour, in contrast to the way that a lot of people remember things very simply as 1913, 1916, 1919, 1921, and Labour gets a look in 1913 and then sort of disappears. In fact, after 1916, the general picture for organised Labour was one of growth and militancy. There were about 100,000 workers in unions that were affiliated to Congress in 1916, but by 1920 there were about 225,000 workers affiliated in those unions. Craft and white-collar workers grew in that era, but the expansion of the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, the union at the centre of the lockout and in many ways supposedly crushed, you know, in 1914, was the most dramatic. That grew from about 5,000 members to around 150,000 members in the space of about 4 years. The number of local trades councils also increased from 15 in 1918 to 46 in 1921. And the trades councils, which often call themselves workers' councils, for example, were very influential in local organisation of labour. And again, unlike the lockout, which again makes the agenda for the centenaries, is what a lot of people think of when they think of Irish labour history, labour's story in this period was a national story. It wasn't just about Dublin, it wasn't just about Belfast. Organised labour reached every corner of the island. And while there's obviously some scholarship about and also popular memory of events like the Limerick Soviet, for example, of April 1919, the movement was far wider than that. An indication of how this confidence translated to ordinary workers, I think, is expressed by the police journal, the RIC Gazette, during 1920, when it lamented how once the police officer had been a vastly superior man to the railway porter and the agricultural labourer, and yet, behold, how they have advanced. And the police were actually complaining about their wages at this stage as well. But again, the fact that they talk about railway porters and agricultural labourers is significant. Also worth recalling again that this expansion occurs under union leaders who were variously described as reformist at best, labour fakers at worst by their left-wing critics, but who were generally far to the left politically of mainstream labour today. And again, often the critiques of these people takes for granted that people will understand this terminology. I think the general political situation was very different in 1918, 1919 than it obviously is today. Now, there were several reasons for the growth in labour militancy. Some of it was linked to the National Revolution. A great deal of the initial impetus, however, came from the economic context, particularly the needs of the United Kingdom and the British state in wartime. And the fact is, for 2 years after 1916, Ireland was still at war. Ireland was also affected by the Bolshevik Revolution. I know there was a lecture a couple of weeks ago by Donald Fallon about this, so I'm not going to dwell on it. But certainly at the time, the iconography of international revolution and international events is very present in Ireland. And not only were British policymakers keenly aware of this context, but that language finds its way into the vocabulary of social struggles in every part of Ireland. And again, I'll quote a few later on, but in every strike and every dispute, you hear people talking about Soviets, you hear people talking about the Bolsheviks. So again, this is very common. But at the basic level of trade union organisation, again, there's a number of reasons why unions begin to regain confidence. Simple one, Dublin had to be rebuilt. And after 1916 up to 1918, construction workers and people who worked in the building industry in Dublin began to gain in confidence because there was a need for their services, and there were three construction strikes during 1918. There was also a brief economic boom at the conclusion of the war, and this again encouraged organisation because a lot of grievances had been stored up since the beginning of the war. While the countryside, particularly the farming economy, had boomed to some extent, prices had risen in the towns and working class living standards hadn't really risen at all. So there was a lot of grievances stored up. There were a lot of wage demands, which in late 1916, as early as that, began to translate into some industrial action. And again, the context of the war was significant because this prompted the state to intervene very often because it didn't want widespread industrial action that might actually interfere with the war effort. So in December 1916, members of the National Union of Railwaymen, which is a British-based union, on the Dublin and South Eastern line struck for a wage rise of 10 shillings. When the company refused to concede, eventually the British government stepped in and took control of Ireland's 32 different railway companies and instituted a 7 shillings a week wage rise. Over the next year, membership of the National Union of Railwaymen grew from 5,000 to 17,000 members in Ireland. And again, people saw joining a union made sense. The importance of the war economy was even more apparent on the land. This is very significant. So the British government needed Ireland for food, and they wanted more food by 1917. They demanded increased production, and during 1917, farmers were ordered to bring 10% of arable land under tillage. In 1918, they were actually asked to bring another 5% of their land under tillage, if possible. Now, tillage was very labour-intensive, and suddenly farm labourers' work was in demand, and they were given a chance to exercise some power. Large farmers and landowners, not surprisingly, demurred at raising pay or improving conditions for these labourers. And in September 1917, the British government set up the Agricultural Wages Board to determine compulsory minimum wages and standards for rural labourers. And among farm workers then, in this era, the old rural land and labour societies were largely superseded by the organising efforts of the Irish Transport Union, which again, as the one big union, adopted syndicalist strategies and began to essentially recruit very widely among rural labourers. By 1920, 60,000 members of the Irish Transport Union were rural workers, mainly concentrated in the southeastern tillage counties, parts of South Kildare, Carlow, parts of Laois, Offaly, for example, down as far as Waterford. But the union also expanded in the west and the southwest. In County Limerick during 1919, there were 38 branches of the Irish Transport Union, organising creamery workers, among others. During that period, there were dozens of workplace occupations. Again, the terminology is significant. In May 1920, you have the Knock Long Soviet, for example. You have another local Soviet at Brewery in April 1921, which featured the famous slogan, "Brewery workers, Soviet mills, we make butter, not profits." And again, it's open to discussion how much of an actual Bolshevik influence there is, but certainly the language of international revolution is very present. And that movement among rural labour was key to making labour a national force. Though they're probably still less well known than things like the Limerick Soviet, which occurred in April 1919, when workers responded to state repression with a general strike and ultimately a takeover of the city for 11 days, they're perhaps more representative of the general movement and conditions in that part of Ireland again. And one of the problems we have, I mean, people like Dominic Hawk, for example, have worked on what happened in Limerick. This era doesn't really have a Connolly or Larkin, and therefore people are often unaware, because these disputes are often led by far less well-known individuals, which have to be rediscovered from history, really. In October 1920, the Transport Union newspaper, The Voice of Labour, described farm workers as the most important section of our population. And that paper warned that while the farmers speak of anarchy and Bolshevism, the big farmers who take up this attitude should reflect that the farm labourer is not now the dumb, driven animal and meek slave that he was in the past. He has a hunger for land. He has a still more acute hunger for life. He has learned what manhood is. Let the ranchers and graziers force him, and he will give them a struggle compared to which the land war of the last century was only a skirmish. So again, I think what's happening, particularly among rural labourers, is very important. But all this was obviously occurring in the aftermath of the Easter Rising, and also in the midst by 1917 of the first election successes for separatist candidates. So what had Labour said in the sense of the Trade Union Congress and Labour Party about those events? And again, people will be probably familiar with some of this. The Labour Party and TUC met in Sligo in August 1916, and the war and economic affairs took up much more discussion than the Easter Rising. And in his presidential address, Thomas Johnson claimed that it was his sad duty to say a word or two regarding the loss which we and the working class movement have sustained through the death of those of our comrades whose lives were sacrificed in the recent rebellion. He said, however, that Congress was not the place to enter into a discussion as to the right or the wrong, the wisdom or the folly of this revolt. Of Connolly, James Connolly, he said, "We mourn his death, we honour his work, we revere his memory," and then continued that while laying these wreaths on the graves of our comrades who gave their lives for what they believed to be the cause of Ireland's freedom, let us also remember the many others, some of whom had been chosen in years past to attend our congresses, who laid down their lives in another field, also for what they believed to be the cause of liberty, democracy and love of country. In other words, he obviously fudged and included both those who died in the war and those who died in the rebellion, and didn't take any kind of clear position on what he said, thought about the rebellion at all. Now, the president of the Irish Transport Union, Tom Foran, responded to questions about the connection between his union and the Citizens' Army by claiming that he was proud of the actions taken by the Citizens' Army, that there was no attempt to repudiate it, and they would allow nobody to repudiate it. But at the same time, he said the Citizens' Army was composed of trade unionists who had their own governing body with control over their own organisation and wasn't necessarily intrinsically linked to Liberty Hall. A motion was passed demanding that those who were being held after the Rising be given a trial without further delay or be released immediately. That was passed unanimously. But in general, as I say, there wasn't a major discussion. And this reflected the fact that there were many sections of the trade union movement who were quite hostile to those who'd been involved in the Rising, or at least very worried about what was going to happen. It was also not clear at the time how all this was going to work out. Significantly, the Congress did pass a motion opposing partition. But their position on the First World War itself was actually less harsh than the position they'd taken in August 1914 when the war had broken out. And as I say, it still wasn't clear how this was going to work out. And the Labour Party in Congress in August 1916 weren't therefore clearly aligned with separatism at all. And that does begin to change, I think. But the fact is, what kind of movement did they represent? Well, in 1917 in Dublin, for example, there were about 18,000 Dubliners in the city's trade unions. And there were around 60 of these unions. And again, right up to the 1970s at least, one of the things that marked Ireland out was this multiplicity of unions, including very, very small unions for very, very small sections of the workforce. There's often several competing versions of each body and many unions which were Irish branches of larger British organisations. And there's also a growing number of associations for white collar and shop workers, women slowly joining the ranks of union members, both in the Women's Workers' Union but also in some of the white collar unions as well. On Dublin Trades Council, for example, aside from representatives of the Transport Union, you had people from the Cab and Car Owners Society, the Sheet Metal Workers Union, the Amalgamated Society of Carpenters, Amalgamated Society of Tailors, Stonecutters Union, Fire Brigade Men's Union, the Dublin Operative Farriers Union, the Hairdresser Society, the Irish Drapers Assistance Union, the United Kingdom Society of Coachmakers, the United Corporation Workmen's Union, and the Dublin Typographical Providence Society, which is a printers union. And that union, for example, a few years before, had sent greetings to William Martin Murphy, acknowledging the spirit of fairness with which he has ever met them in trades union matters. And that was in relation to the week's paid holidays that printers at the Irish Independent enjoyed. So there's quite a diversity on the Trades Council. And these unions all have distinct histories. When we talk again about the labour movement, the working class, you know, you're not talking about one body that moves, that just moves in unison. There were no women on the Trade Council at that point. Same time, 1917, republicanism is clearly becoming a mass movement. There's general amnesty of prisoners, huge receptions on their return, reorganisation of the Irish Volunteers, and several election victories that year. And I think the makeup of that movement is significant too when we talk about Labour during the revolution. One man interned after the Rising, Gerald Doyle, described his comrades who were in jail with him as doctors, solicitors, chemists and men who were prominent in the public life of the city, civil servants, tradesmen and schoolmasters, as well as farmers, all of whom make up the decent citizens of a country. Now, it's interesting who isn't in his list, and that mightn't be deliberate. But the fact is, most Republican activists were tradesmen, white-collar workers. You had a lot of grocers' assistants or barmen. I mean, 9 members of the Irish National Union of Vintners, Grocers and Allied Trades died as IRA volunteers between 1919 and 1921, including the union's national president, Paddy Moran. And that shows, in fact, how many members of that profession were involved in Republican politics. There's also a substantial number of civil servants and a sprinkling of students. In fact, an over-representation of students, given how few people went to university at the time. And that's reflected far more starkly in the political leadership of republicanism. About 65% of members of the First Dáil and around 58% of the Second Dáil's TDs came from the commercial and professional classes. And that's a huge overrepresentation of those categories in comparison to their numbers in Ireland at the time. They made up about 10% of the population. So there was lawyers, teachers, lecturers, journalists, doctors, few businessmen, publicans, the odd Catholic aristocrat, good few self-employed tradesmen, and a few farmers. Actually, farmers quite underrepresented among the Republican leadership as well, although a lot of the people are farmers' sons or daughters. There's no unskilled urban or rural labourers. There's a couple of people whose parents might have been, but there's none in the Dáil. That doesn't change very much for a while either. Around 60% of TDs in 1921 had attended secondary school, perhaps a quarter university. And again, these numbers are far in excess of the general population at the time. Now, sometimes people think this is a judgment on these people. I'm just pointing out the fact that actually the makeup of the Labour movement is quite different from the makeup of the Republican movement in some senses at various stages, particularly the transport union and the unskilled workers. Now, the Sinn Féin leadership tended to be more middle class than the volunteers, though a lot of TDs were volunteer officers. But while they were unskilled workers involved in the IRA, in proportion to their numbers in Ireland at the time, I think they were underrepresented. Now, perhaps I'm being needlessly revisionist here because, again, one of the things you find when you go through the Bureau of Military History statements is the number of people who came from homes which employed servants, for example. In 1916, there seems to have been no domestic servants involved in Cumann na mBan, but there were quite a few Cumann na mBan members who employed domestic servants. Now, there's about 13,000 women in Dublin working as servants of various types, so they're part of the working class as well. And aside from some of the women workers attached to the Citizens' Army, who came through the Women Workers' Union, for example, the Republican women in 1916, I think, are much generally better off than the Republican male rank and file. And I think that is a factor we can't ignore. But of course, Republicans were also active in the labour movement, particularly in the craft unions. And you also had people like Cathal O'Shannon, who's editor of the Transport Unions paper, who'd been in the IRB out in 1916 and interned. But again, it's interesting the way that Republicans engaged with organised labour. And one way, probably not surprisingly, was through clandestine organisation. During 1919, Martin Conlon, who was a Dublin Corporation sanitary officer and a member of the IRB Supreme Council, was put in charge of a secret service unit known as the Labour Board by Michael Collins. And this body also included Thomas Maguire of the Station Engine Driver Society, Joseph Toomey of the Amalgamated Society of Engineers, and Luke Kennedy, who was an electrician. And Conlon described how their duty was to use our influence in various trade unions and in the labour movement generally on behalf of the Republic to get hold of men in important key positions, such as power stations, railways and transport, dock workers, etc. And most important of all, to undermine the amalgamated and cross-channel unions, and where possible, to organise breakaways from these unions and establish purely Irish unions instead. And you could see from a military point of view why organisation in certain sectors would have been very significant, and also why they might want to ideologically work against the British-based unions. Although, again, membership of British-based unions didn't seem to, as we'll see, necessarily mean that you were anti-republican. The formation of the Irish Engineering, Shipbuilding and Foundry Trades Union in 1920 was part of this process, and Pádraig Yates has written quite a bit about it. And from that union, ultimately, the Electrical Trades Union and NITU emerged, which later on became the TEWU, which is why that union's badge last year featured Countess Markievicz, who was Minister for Labour in the Dáil during 1920. You then also had men such as Sean O'Duffy, who was secretary of a different electrical trades union in 1920 and a veteran of the Rising, but was nevertheless involved in supplying men, electricians, to do maintenance work in the various British Army barracks in Dublin. Obviously, barracks needed maintenance. There wasn't that many electricians around, so the British worked through O'Duffy. Now, O'Duffy was able to convince the Royal Engineers to give him a special pass that allowed him to travel after curfew, which he then provided for the use of Michael Collins and others within the IRA. The fact is, Sean O'Duffy is probably remembered more for his role in the GAA than he is for the Labour movement. The O'Duffy Cup, which is given to the winners of the All-Ireland Camogie Trophy, is named after him. But in 1920, he was a leading trade unionist in the Electrical Trades Union, and also therefore was able to use that position to aid the IRA. In early 1917, a group of activists, many of them members of the IRB, took control of the Dublin Municipal Officers Association, a local government union, and they then later used that union to launch the Irish Local Government Officers Trade Union, which was a trade union of local government officials that supported Dáil Éireann after 1919. And members of this group included Harry Mangan, who was city accountant, Joseph Hutchinson, who also worked in the accountant's office in Dublin, Thomas Gay of the Capel Street Library, and their leading figure was really Harry Nicholls, who was a 1916 veteran as well. Martin Maguire has written a lot about that aspect of white-collar trade unionism and its relationship to the Republican movement. When I talk about clandestine operations, I suppose it's worth noting in passing that some pro-treaty IRA veterans who were trade unionists seem to have been sent to do secret work in the unions during the Civil War as well, and for all I know, on the anti-treaty side too. But this obviously was a tradition, was one way in which unions interacted with the national struggle. But by 1918, it was clear that organised labour, particularly the transport union, was becoming a major force in Irish society. And at leadership level, both the Transport Union and the Labour Party in Congress began to identify with international revolution and also with the demand for national self-determination. And again, it's probably been mentioned in previous week's talks, but there's a big rally at the Mansion House, February 1918, in support of the Bolshevik Revolution. In the Voice of Labour of 23rd of February 1918, Thomas Johnson writes an article about what might happen if the Bolsheviks came to Ireland. And he said, "It's right that our friends who join with us in acclaiming the Bolshevik Revolution should understand its implications. It means that in a society based upon labour, labour shall rule." And he also says that in Ireland, the Irish version of the Red Guards could be the local units of the Irish Republican Army. In other words, he's very verbally, at least publicly, again, aligning the transport union or Congress with the idea of self-determination. And Labour's political influence, nobody can really ignore their importance following the conscription crisis of April 1918. The threat of conscription provokes a wave of protest across Ireland and a display of almost complete nationalist unity, as opposed to national unity, because it's not opposed everywhere, but it's opposed certainly in nationalist Ireland. And William O'Brien of the Transport Union and Thomas Johnson are part of the nine-man anti-conscription committee that's set up alongside Sinn Féin and various Home Rule leaders to oppose the measure. Plans for mass passive resistance are drawn up. The unions talk about taking control of food supplies in the railways, for example. On Saturday, the 20th of April 1918, 1,500 delegates, among them artisans, transport workers, drapers' assistants, and the press also claims many ladies, attended a special convention in the Mansion House, which backed the call for a general strike a few days later on Tuesday, the 23rd of April. So, again, this strike is being organised fairly rapidly. By then, 100,000 workers had signed an anti-conscription pledge. Strike is organised despite press censorship in most areas outside Belfast. Only banks, law courts and government offices stayed open. Members of British-based unions struck along with their Irish counterparts. In Dublin there were no bread deliveries, grocery, victualling establishments and restaurants were closed, pubs, theatres, cinemas and music halls also shut. No trams ran, and while some hotels tried to defy the strike, by afternoon most staff had left their workplaces, leaving guests to serve themselves. Now, it's customary to point out that the strike is a success everywhere outside of the area around Belfast. There's some evidence of support for the anti-conscription cause there too, but of course it's significant that this is the one place in Ireland where Johnson goes to address the anti-conscription meeting. He's hit on the head by a rock, and the meeting that he's addressing is broken up by young loyalist workers. And it's also in this period that the teachers' union, for example, begins to split. But nevertheless, in the aftermath of the anti-conscription strike, the Irish Times asserts that it was the voice of Labour, not the voice of religion or politics, which yesterday stopped the wheels of industry. We think that April 23rd will be chiefly remembered, not as the day when nationalist Ireland proclaimed their spiritual and moral isolation, but as the day when Labour found itself. Again, you could argue maybe they're being a bit self-serving there, but certainly you can't ignore the power of Labour after the 23rd of April 1918. And a couple of weeks later, there's the May Day events, and these reflect the confidence of the Labour movement, with thousands of people taking part in rallies across the country. And in 1918, the Labour leadership affirms their support for Irish self-determination, but not explicitly for a republic. And on the 1st of November 1918, the Irish Trade Union and Labour Party Congress accepted a recommendation from their leadership not to contest the forthcoming general election. And that vote is 96 to 23. Now again, this is a long story and there are many different versions of what went on. Sinn Féin offered Labour safe seats, few safe seats in return for not contesting most constituencies. The prospect of actually taking part seems to have frightened, at least perplexed, the Labour leadership. If they did badly, electoral defeat could shatter the growing confidence of the movement. If they did well, then they were faced with whether or not to abstain from Westminster, which they were not committed to doing. And again, this could have caused all sorts of problems. And O'Brien and Johnson erred on the side of caution. They stood back. Opposition to this came from Labourites in Belfast, who both wanted to avoid association with the Republican cause, but also to challenge the Unionists locally. And four candidates from the Labour Representation Committee did stand in Belfast. They won 12,000 votes, but no seats. Their best result was about 3,600 votes for Sam Coyle, who was a textile workers' organiser on the Shankill. But he was well behind the Unionist Samuel McGuffin's 11,840 votes. And Samuel McGuffin stood as a Labour Unionist. And wherever the Unionist Party was confronted by Labour candidates, they rebranded their candidates Labour Unionists, which reflected the fact that they knew there was a market for Labour out there as well. And they won all those contests. Now, it became fashionable, and it still is fashionable, from a variety of perspectives, both Labourite and left Republican, to suggest that in 1918, Eamon de Valera demanded that Labour must wait, and the Labour leaders acquiesced fatally for long-term hopes of establishing a place in Irish politics. In fact, De Valera never actually said this. Again, Rainer Lyset wrote about this in Sayre back in 2001, I think. The Belfast Home Ruler Joe Devlin alleged that this was what Sinn Féin's policy amounted to. The fact was, I think De Valera was far too clever a politician to make a demand like that on a movement that actually was quite strong. In reality, the Labour leadership didn't have to be asked to wait, and they didn't have the ambition to compete with Sinn Féin in most of Ireland. Sinn Féin, as a result, in some ways, were very complimentary in their public utterances about Labour. In April 1919, De Valera, for example, said, "When we wanted the help of Labour against conscription, Labour gave it to us. When we wanted the help of Labour in Berne," which I'll come back to, "Labour gave it to us and got Ireland recognised as a distinct nation. When we wanted Labour to stand down at the election and not divide us, but so we could stand four square against the enemy, Labour fell in with us. I say Labour deserves well of the Irish people. The Labour man deserves the best the country can give." In August 1921, a lot has happened in that couple of years. De Valera addresses the Trade Union Congress conference and he tells them, "It's not necessary for me to say, you know it so well, that were it not for the solidarity of Labour behind the national cause, the Irish cause would not be where it is today. We who are in a position to gauge the advance of the Irish cause know what your support has been to us, and what your refusal to put forward even your own interests has meant for the cause of Ireland in the past 2 years." So in many ways, not really a case of Labour being told to wait, but Labour seeming pretty content to wait. And Sinn Féin actually probably benefited themselves electorally from their association with Labour, the general strike against conscription and the revolutionary mood in post-war Europe, the fact that republics were being formed across Europe and the idea of national self-determination was in the air. And during the 1918 election, a number of union leaders spoke at Sinn Féin rallies. Cork National Union of Railwaymen official John Good, again interesting that he's a member of a British-based union, he speaks on Sinn Féin platforms and he says, "Labour and Sinn Féin are one and the same thing." And he says, "They both stand for a workers' republic. Sinn Féin election material appealed to workers to keep Connolly's flag flying and asserted that the demand for an Irish republic had the support of the government of the Russian republics and the workers of France, Germany and Australia. Cork Sinn Féin candidate Liam de Ruyter stated that the day had come when the working classes will have the power in the government of this country." And again, he stressed that this would happen when Sinn Féin came to power. Now, the December 18 election is the first in which property qualifications didn't apply to men over 21. And therefore, it's the first election in which very large numbers of both working class and lower middle class men could vote. Position of women is a lot more problematic. It's only a relatively small number of women over 30 who get the vote. But for men over 21, this is the first election a lot of them could have voted in. There's been, I suppose, relatively little research done on the class makeup of Sinn Féin's vote. We all know Sinn Féin got a very significant vote, but the 18 election does see considerable conflict in urban areas between Republicans and supporters of the Home Rule Party. And in Ulster, these are sometimes members of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, for example. But in other areas, Republicans tended to claim that they were ex-British servicemen and their families, the notorious separation women, who we all know from 1916, but they turn up again in all sorts of places in 1918 as well. And Republicans tended to have a very low opinion of these people. One claimed, for example, in Waterford during 1918, that drink was flowing. To see that fanatical separation money mob, one could not help thinking what Daniel O'Connell thought when he said, "You should know the animals I'm supposed to make a nation out of." Sinn Féin's opponents are variously described by Republicans as roughs, the rabble, tinkers, toughs, etc. Now, how much these impressions are actually influenced by class and gender bias is difficult to discern, because in Belfast, many of Joe Devlin's most vocal supporters were the women workers from the mills, for example. Some of them may have been related to British soldiers, but I don't think that explains it all at all. And I don't think that explains everything in other parts of Ireland either. Certainly a lot of the Home Rule Party's remaining support was driven by local factors. And it's clear that some of the urban poor remained loyal to it. Again, people like to use the magical term lumpen, which I think is a word the left likes to give to members of the working class it doesn't like. I don't think it explains this either. The residents of the lanes in Irish rural towns were also part of the Irish working class, and I think what they taught is very, very difficult to discover, because they didn't write diaries and they didn't write articles for newspapers. But nevertheless, this is a factor in the conflicts of 1918. Sinn Féin's electoral landslide does create a virtual consensus in most of Ireland for self-determination. And, you know, having not committed himself to the idea of a republic, Thomas Johnson is still asked to draft a democratic programme for the First Dáil, and this of course is adopted by the First Dáil. Now, some people argue essentially what Sinn Féin were looking at was the Berne Conference of International Socialist Parties, and they wanted Ireland to get recognition at that, and the democratic programme was something they could show to that conference about the social ideas of the Irish Republic. Johnson's original version asserted that the state should control the nation's resources and that the Republic will eliminate the class in society which lives upon the wealth produced by the workers but gives no useful service in return, and in the process of accomplishment will bring freedom to all who have hitherto been caught in the toils of economic servitude. Now again, there's a lot of contested versions of this, and Michael Collins and the IRB seem to have found that version too radical, allegedly threatened to suppress it. Therefore, the programme is partly rewritten by Sean T. O'Kelly. And the revised programme is then introduced on the day the First Dáil meets. It's introduced in Irish by Piers Beasley. He apparently translates it as he goes along, so his version isn't necessarily how it would read in Irish. And then in English by the veteran Dublin Sinn Féiner, Tom Kelly. Its adoption was recommended by Richard Mulcahy, who said that a nation cannot be fully free while the least part of its people are without freedom. A nation cannot live fully and refuse any part of its people the right to the resources and wealth which God gave us all to live and prosper. Now, in rewritten form, the programme still stated that all rights of private property must be subordinated to the public right and welfare, and that no child shall suffer hunger or cold or lack of food, clothing or shelter in the new state. The Irish Times claimed that this raised the spectre of Irish Bolshevism and that the principles of Lenin and Trotsky were now being applied to Irish affairs. But it has to be said, the democratic programme isn't that widely discussed in press coverage of the First Dáil, and perhaps that might be due to censorship to some extent. Subsequently, some Sinn Féin TDs, again notably Kevin O'Higgins, claimed that the document never reflected what they believed in. A lot of them said they'd never obviously read it before it was proposed to the Dáil. But Johnson and Cathal O'Shannon were dispatched to Berne to lobby the first post-war International Socialist Conference on Ireland's right to statehood, and they could claim to have brought this document with them. And again, Emmett O'Connor and Andreas O'Kosig and other people have written quite critically about the document and the various theories that accompany its adoption. It's fair to say that nearly 100 years on, it's pretty iconic. In Dermot Ferrier's series on television, The Limits of Liberty, a few years ago, the whole series was essentially about how the democratic programme had never been put into effect by the Irish state. In The Wind That Shakes the Barley, there's the scene where Dan, the ex-Citizens Army man, quotes from the democratic programme as part of his opposition to the treaty. Now, I'm not actually sure how many of the Republican rank and file were very aware of the democratic programme during the War of Independence. But its popularity today strikes me as interesting for a number of reasons. One, it was largely written by Thomas Johnson, who was the leader, you know, wasn't a member of the Republican movement, leader of what becomes the Labour Party, who Republicans would deride as a reformist at best, at worst a pro-treatyite. And Padraig O'Donnell, I think, is responsible for a lot of that. When I first read Padraig O'Donnell, I thought Thomas Johnson had been responsible for the executions during the Civil War, because it's extremely bitter. I mean, it really does hold him up as a hate figure, and this doesn't really correspond with what went on. And secondly, because during the treaty debates itself, it's interesting, the democratic programme is referenced by the pro-treaty side. Joe McGrath, who had been a manager in the Transport Union Insurance section, was close to Labour, but by 1921 was a Sinn Féin TD, supported the treaty. He quoted from the democratic programme during the treaty debates on the need for the state to ensure that no child would suffer from hunger or want, and argued that under this treaty, every single thing in the democratic programme can be put into force. Now, during the Civil War, McGrath actually spent more time organising a death squad than he did pondering the democratic programme. But it's still interesting that the pro-treaty side could reference it. And again, all the men who proposed it in January 1919, Mulcahy, Beasley and all the rest, they were all pro-treatyites ultimately. So again, it shows you how we probably shouldn't read history backwards and assume that people are going to be on certain sides. But it's certainly, again, iconic. And in a couple of years, there'll be no shortage of discussion about it. But there's another element of class conflict which was going on at the time, which was in some ways more problematic for the Republican movement than what the Transport Union was doing necessarily. And this was agrarian conflict. And it raises another question about another truism about Irish history, and that's that the land question was solved essentially in the 1890s and wasn't a factor anymore by the time the Easter Rising happened. Fergus Campbell in his book Land and Revolution goes into that in some detail. In fact, the revolutionary era saw what the Sinn Féiner and Dáil Court judge Kevin O'Shiel described as the last land war. He described how in the spring of 1920, all bonds were broken and the fever swept with the fury of a prairie fire over Connacht, and portions of other provinces, sparing neither great ranch nor medium farm, and inflicting in its headlong course sad havoc on man, beast, and property. And the rural society from which Sinn Féin was now drawing much support was harshly divided between farmers of varying wealth, small farmers, labourers, and the remaining landlord class. During 1919, Dublin Castle recorded what they called 175 agrarian outrages, which means incidents of agrarian agitation, 8 of which involved the use of firearms. Between January and June 1920, the number of these outrages rose to 822, 32 of them involving firearms. And this agitation spread to 16 counties between March and June 1920, resulting in more incidents in any year since 1882, in other words, since the land war. Now, during the war years, there's a number of reasons for this. During the war years, the Congested Districts Board, which had been set up to try and do something about the poverty in the West, had largely ceased to purchase land for redistribution. And as a result of wartime restrictions on emigration, by 1920, there's lots of young men, non-inheriting farmers, sons, landless labourers, for example, who need land so they could try to make a living. Wartime and post-war prosperity on the land had also meant the acquisition of land was an even more attractive prospect. By 1920, the apparatus of the British state in Ireland was also severely weakened, particularly in some areas of the West, by the activities of the IRA or by the withdrawal of the police. So there's very little practical opposition to a lot of land agitation in some cases. So therefore, people feel that they can get away with things they wouldn't have got away with before. In February 1920, the police county inspector in Galway observed that the small farmers, their sons and labourers, are taking advantage of the general unrest to force owners and occupiers of grazing lands to surrender their lands for division among the agitators. Several killings in Galway in particular during 1920, including that of a large landowner, Frank Shaw Taylor, are believed to be more connected to land agitation than the IRA's campaign. Now, some seizures are cattle drives where grazing cattle were driven off land and then people tried to divide that land up, were carried out in the name of the IRA, particularly in 1918 or 1919, and they were accompanied by displays of Republican flags and bunting, for example. And during April 1920, the Irish Times again maliciously drew attention to the sleepless nights it claimed this agrarian Bolshevism was supposedly causing for Sinn Féin supporting farmers. The Catholic Bishop of Galway condemned land seizures, and at an extraordinary Sinn Féin meeting in Galway, where people expressed sympathy with the idea of land distribution, many speakers made clear that the recent movement towards in the recent movement towards land reform, great abuses had occurred. The official publication, The Constructive Work of Dáil Éireann, published by the Dáil itself, put it like this: all of this was a grave menace to the Republic. The mind of the people was being diverted from the struggle for freedom by a class war, and there was a likelihood that this class war might be carried into the ranks of the Republican Army itself, which was drawn in the main from the agricultural population. Now again, there's a number of things you can say about that, but certainly this type of land agitation seems to have worried the Dáil far more than strikes in urban areas, for example. The Cork IRA leader Sean Moylan later remembered that the IRA in 1920-21 were engaged in an unselfish struggle for the freedom of this country. An attempt was made by many selfish people in many areas to cash in on the work of the IRA. And in Mayo and many parts of the West, attempts were made to cover up, under the idea that it was IRA activity, the work of people who wanted something for themselves and didn't give a damn about the nation. I remember very well a discussion by IRA headquarters about the cleaning up of cattle drivers, and they were cleaned up by the IRA. And again, there's a lot more can be said about this, because there wasn't one IRA attitude to these agitations at all. But certainly it does seem to have worried the Republican movement. In the East and Southeast, conflict on the land was of a different nature, and I mentioned that earlier on. During the summer of 1919, for example, in parts of Meath and Kildare, which are big grazing counties, farm labourers mobilised against the farm owners through the transport union. Farmers themselves were organised in a farmers' association. And again, the Farmers' Journal noted that Sinn Féin had won the backing of much of the farming community, but that some of these farmers were worried by what seemed to be the close alliance between the transport union and the Republican movement. And the Meath farmers, at least, or graziers, found to their cost that rural labourers who were organised in an urban-based trade union could be a very powerful force. Because when they tried to export their cattle, they couldn't, because Dublin and Drogheda dockers, who were members of the transport union as well, refused to load them. On August 16th, the farmers tried to avoid the blockade by running a special cattle train to Belfast. The train was derailed at Navan, where 15 feet of track had been torn up. A limited shipment reached Belfast later on under military escort, but again, dockers refused to handle the cattle and they were eventually brought back to pasture. And the farmers were forced to concede many of the labourers' demands. What's interesting is that the train was derailed by the IRA. The farm workers had approached the IRA in Meath under Sean Boylan, and yes, he's related to the other Sean Boylan as well, and the IRA agreed to take this action on their behalf. And again, I'm not sure how widely known that was at the time, but again, it's interesting that they were prepared to do that. And again, you see a relative benevolence towards the transport union and disputes like this in comparison to the way that the Republican movement is worried about land agitation and cattle driving in the West. But the conflict between the IRA and the Crown Forces also, of course, impacted on the Labour movement. And here the Labour movement again plays a very significant role. On the 5th of April 1920, 100 prisoners refused food in Mountjoy Prison in demand for prisoner of war status, 100 IRA prisoners. The initial response of Dublin Castle was to refuse any compromise. On the 12th of April, Congress called an indefinite general strike as a protest against the inhuman treatment of political prisoners and to demand their immediate release. And what's significant about this general strike, again, is it shows the reach of the transport union, particularly into provincial Ireland. There's stoppages in Rathangan, in Maynooth, in Killala, in Mayo, in Virginia, in Cavan, as well as in all the large towns and cities, again, outside Belfast. The confidence of workers is also expressed in the number of cases where trades councils took over organisation of the day-to-day running of the locality. In Tralee, the local transport union secretary reported that the trades council was turned into a workers' council who took full control of everything. We had our own police who kept order, saw that all business was suspended, issued permits for everything required. Pickets patrolled the streets. In fact, the workers controlled all. In Bagnallstown, on the second day of the strike, the local organisers proclaimed the establishment of a provisional Soviet government to police the town, to keep order and ration out the food supplies. Local workers paraded by a special banner released to prisoners, and a local brass band joined by women and children, the Christian Brothers and school chaps, transport workers, railway men, shop assistants, ex-soldiers and others paraded in the town. Similarly, in Athlone, the transport union reported that every ex-soldier in the town was with us. Athlone was solid to a man. In Virginia, activists had a very enjoyable time. The transport members all struck work and all other labourers joined in with them. In Maynooth, all work was suspended. It may be mentioned that with one solitary exception, the procession was composed of workers only, which goes to show the sincerity of the mouthings of the bosses with Ireland the nation. The procession carrying the tricolour and red flags made a most imposing display, bonfires being lit in the market square. In Killala, all members of the branch of the transport union formed a procession three deep in the evening and carried a tar barrel headed by the local branch secretary under the banner of Labour, followed by members of the Sinn Féin clubs and Cumann na Mban. The Reverend Canon O'Reilly parish priest and all the leading men of the town also took a prominent part in the procession. Kilkenny, not a single man going out to work on Tuesday or a single house of business opened either. It was really magnificent, their response. And the Guardian, the Manchester Guardian, claimed about Waterford that the city was taken over by a Soviet commissar and three associates. The Sinn Féin mayor abdicated and the Soviet issued orders to the population, which they all had to obey. For 2 days, until a telegram arrived reporting the release of the hunger strikers, the city was in the hands of these men. The Guardian also suggested that the direction of affairs passed during the strike to the councils, which were formed not on a local but on a class basis. It is no exaggeration to trace the flavour of a proletarian dictatorship about some aspects of this strike. Now, there's no doubt that identification with international revolt was a feature of these events. And in many places, red flags are carried alongside tricolours, and the red flag was sung as well as our own Navin. But in most areas, the crowds attending these strike rallies also included local Republicans, and they often featured Catholic clergy in prominent roles. Priests are often speakers at the strike rallies as well, for example. So it's a very broad movement. But nevertheless, Labour is central. And again, Labour is not confined to a couple of large towns. It's right across the country. After 2 days, the authorities began releasing the prisoners. And in both Britain and Ireland, this was seen as a response to the general strike. It was seen as a great triumph by Sinn Féin and the Irish Labour Party. That was how it was reported. And a humiliation for Dublin Castle, who'd been very hardline about the protest, but caved in, essentially. How long have I got, John?
10 minutes,
okay. Okay, I'll abridge some of this. Shortly after that strike, Labour intervened again when workers refused to move troops and military equipment. And again, this is a longer story. The actions began at Dublin and Dunleary in late May 1920 when dockers declined to unload weapons from two ships. British troops eventually completed this task, only to find that railway workers then refused to transport the arms. And these workers, again, many of them were members of the National Union of Railwaymen, and they were inspired by the example of workers in London who'd refused to load ships containing equipment for the anti-Bolshevik forces in Poland. Now, several of the British unions had officially endorsed that boycott, but they were very troubled by the consequences of a similar boycott in Ireland, and they never officially endorsed the boycott here. Nevertheless, by June, many railwaymen were refusing to load or transport either military equipment or armed troops. This wasn't an official strike, and there were a number of things about it, which again we might come back to. The Congress called on all those who profess and call themselves nationalist Republicans or trade unionists to contribute to a special fund in order to pay for people who were dismissed from work. About £120,000 was raised, which enabled the unions to pay about £3 per week to the over 500 men who were dismissed. But the unions were wary of an all-out confrontation, so railwaymen were instructed to work as normal, with the exception of munitions work. Workers nevertheless faced very considerable intimidation from the British military, who tried to force them to move equipment, for example. Nevertheless, the boycott continued into the winter of 1920 and caused a lot of disruption to British military transport. But by December 1920, with the number of railwaymen who were being dismissed increasing, and also the armed struggle becoming much more violent by that stage, the unions recommended that their members carry anything that the British were willing to risk on the trains. Nevertheless, the British commander in Ireland, Neville Macready, lamented that the boycott had been a serious setback to military actions during the most of the previous year. Now, again, how these events are remembered is interesting, because, again, there's a scene in A Wind That Shakes the Barley that reflects on the transport boycott, and maybe we can come back to that. Some Labour activists took a more direct role in the IRA, not just those in the craft unions. Tighe Barry, who was a transport union organiser in Cork, was also an officer in the Volunteers. He was imprisoned and he was actually murdered while interned in Ballykinler after the truce during late 1921. Michael Nevin was an IRA officer in Sligo, but he seems to have stood as a Labour candidate in the local elections in 1920. Again, Paddy Moran, who was executed in 1921, was national president of the Grocers and Vintners Union. Trade union halls and labour meetings were targeted for reprisals by the British military. In Cork, the Transport Union Hall was burnt down. The Voice of Labour was banned by the British authorities in September 1919, and its replacement, the Watchword of Labour, was suppressed in December 1920. Was there any political payoff for Labour's role in this struggle? Well, in the January 1920 Urban District Council elections, Labour won 394 seats and came second only to Sinn Féin again in most of Ireland. Now, again, not all these candidates were members of the same organisations. There were regional divergences, for example, but it was still a very strong showing for a party at a local level which wasn't even formally a party at that stage. But Labour stood aside in the general elections of 1921, so the second Dáil was composed entirely at that stage of unopposed Sinn Féin candidates. It's not until Easter 1921 that Congress begins to put demands on the Republican government. There's a recession by that stage, there's growing unemployment, there's worries about food supplies, and Congress publishes a document called The Country in Danger, which spells out their concerns over wage levels, over rising prices, argues that tillage and not cattle rearing should be the mainstay of the Irish economy, and also that workers had to be given control over their labour in any new Republican state. But it's fair to say Labour benefits from a benevolent Republican movement and helps them when it can, but it doesn't put a great deal of pressure on them to benefit it. These weaknesses are more evident again, obviously, in North East Ulster. There's plenty of militancy in Belfast. In January 1919, there's a strike by 30,000 engineering and shipbuilding workers who struck for the 44-hour week. They were joined by municipal employees. The city was brought to a halt. British troops were sent in to restore services. Unionist press in this period is warning that Sinn Féin are benefiting from this disruption, that this again is Bolshevism, claims that Polish and Russian Jews have been sighted in the city infiltrating the trade unions. They're probably actually more worried by the fact that some of the strike leaders were Catholic than that. But nevertheless, big card that the unionists play is that returning unionist ex-servicemen are not going to get jobs. They're going to be replaced by Catholics. and that industrial disruption will allow Sinn Féin to come in and essentially take over. In the January 1920 Urban District Council elections, Labour does stand in Belfast. It wins 12 seats out of 60 on Belfast Corporation, and Sam Coyle actually tops the poll on the Shankill. But nevertheless, by the summer of 1920, sectarianism re-emerges with a vengeance. During the munitions strike, for example, loyalists sometimes forced railway workers in Belfast to either sign a pledge of loyalty or leave their jobs. And other loyalist workers declared that they were willing to transport British military on a point of principle, obviously, despite their union's opinions. From July 1920, you have the expulsion of Catholics and the so-called rotten prods from the city shipyards and engineering works, and an escalation of violence then into 1922. And Congress really essentially withdraws from this. They in some ways, are accepting partition to a great extent. By then, by 1922, there's been a truce and negotiations in London, and Congress welcomes the end of the conflict. They rhetorically proclaim a socialist alternative. They state in January 1922 that whatever the outcome of the treaty debates, workers will plainly and openly face a fight against capitalism. The hour is now struck for workers to emerge from the shade. Voice of Labour claims that whatever form of government might be established, whatever name it might assume, free state or republic, unless it realises Labour aspirations, it is not a republic in the eyes of the workers. In reality, Labour is going to accept the treaty, and they're of course prepared to recognise the free state. Though a reading of the Labour press again suggests that this issue is not always foremost in their minds at local level. So in February 1922, the Voice of Labour reports on what it calls the class war in the South. And there's a wave of strikes again in early 1922, often involving transport union members and creameries and so on. In Whitechurch, County Tipperary, transport union members are on strike against local large farmers. They take over a creamery. At this stage, the local IRA is used to break the strike. The Voice of Labour reports that a farmer's son is commander of the local IRA, that one volunteer refused to act against the strikers, but the others took sides. And this begins to happen a lot more in 1922. And again, the IRA is divided over this, but Congress was also conscious of the fact that the revolutionary tide was ebbing. The economy was in recession, unemployment was growing, union membership began to decline. In Britain, the unions were in retreat, and the revolutionary wave across Europe was slowing. Of course, there were activists at the time who saw the treaty as a betrayal of the national struggle. Citizens' Army, which I haven't mentioned, existed, and it's divided over the issue. And Republicans in general, by the summer of 1922, tend to see the Labour and Congress as essentially pro-treaty. But again, when you look at some of the micro debates, I mean, it's interesting. Winifred Kearney writes in the Voice of Labour in the spring of 1922, and she says, "There was a time when James Connolly wouldn't have opposed a Home Rule Bill for Ireland as a stepping stone. There's not therefore much use in attempting to guess which side he or any of the other signatories of the proclamation of 1916 would take at the present juncture." Of course, that hasn't stopped everybody speculating about what they would have, the side they would have taken on any issue since then, let alone the treaty. But it's interesting that Winifred Kearney, who's closely associated, obviously, with left-wing republicanism, would say that at the time. And the Transport Union and Congress really focus on the fear of a civil war and its impact on workers, as well as increasingly on resentment of what it sees as dictatorial tendencies from both sides of the IRA. And in the spring of 1922, you see a lot of articles in the Voice of Labour, a lot of complaints about how the IRA is behaving, both the pro-treaty section, which is becoming the National Army, and the anti-treaty section. The Voice of Labour argues, "Since the truce, we've seen grow up in the ranks of the IRA a spirit of militarism in sheer imitation of the militarism of the British, French, German, American and other armies. Both pro and anti-treaty forces are accused of committing acts which were a direct copy of the worst methods of British imperialism." Talks about the witnesses, the arrogance of the regulars, which are the Free State side, who use the revolver as their only weapon of argument and their only authority. It says, "Perhaps the incidents on the other side, the anti-treaty side, are more numerous, but that's perhaps the more truly are due to lack of central control. That makes them no less and no more heinous and as foolish as anything the armed militarists of England have ever committed." But what Labour are really doing is standing back from this, and arguing, of course, that a war would be disastrous. And it's interesting that their one response is a general strike on the 24th of April 1922. And that general strike is as big as the strike against conscription. And it's very widely supported, which would suggest a lot of workers were afraid of civil war and weren't really prepared to come down very strongly on either side. Now, again, a lot of it is a plague on both your houses. Republicans view it as a pro-treaty strike, but nevertheless, any strike is hard to organise, and general strikes, I would think, are pretty hard to organise. So the fact that it was pretty solid would suggest a lot of workers were not prepared to endorse either side in the spring of 1922. And I think the Labour vote in June 1922 also suggests that. Labour stands 18 candidates in the treaty election. Now, what's interesting again, and this mightn't be very profound, but when you think about the treaty, and certainly the way I always thought about it, you know, was that in 1922, that must be what everybody was interested in. You're either pro or anti-treaty. You're for Michael Collins, you're for Dev. You look at that election, in this constituency, centre of Dublin, Laurence O'Neill, a former Home Ruler, tops the poll, walks the election. Alfie Byrne comes second, another former Home Ruler, and one of the great chancellors of our, not our times, but some people's times, nevertheless, comes second. Pro-treatyite comes third. Sean T. O'Kelly, anti-treaty, scrapes in at fourth. Like, in the centre of Dublin, two candidates who come top are not explicitly part of that debate, even though they are essentially pro-treaty, because they're going to take their seats in any new parliament. Labour stands 18 candidates, 17 of them are elected, 5 of them top the poll. They win 2 seats in Waterford, East Tipperary, Wexford, Kildare and East Cork. They win 50% of the vote in Leash Offaly. And again, those constituencies are constituencies where there'd been major mobilisations of farm workers, and a lot of the Labour candidates are union organisers. In Waterford, Tipperary East, the Labour candidate is John Butler, who's that very rare beast, a farmer trade union official. But so this, I think, reflects, again, a level of working class discontent with the treaty debate. Certainly, the Communist Party is very strongly opposed to the treaty, supports IRA resistance to it, but it's glad to note the sweeping victories of the Labour Party, and it optimistically says, this shows how easy it would be for a revolutionary Labour Party to sweep the field clean of all adversaries and establish a workers' republic. It matters not for the moment that the successful candidates are all of the usual type of Labour betrayers and fakers. They were elected because the workers believed in all their hypocritical declarations about the workers' republic and James Connolly. But it's interesting that in the midst of this, the Workers' Republic, the Communist Party's paper suggests, a big percentage of the Irish are apathetic to the struggle. This is particularly true of the landless peasants and the workers in the cities and the big towns. Now again, you know, it's one view, but it does suggest that the Communists recognise that, you know, the treaty debate is not what is crucial to a lot of the working class constituency. The Communist Party's ideas about how Republicans could offer something to workers and bring them round to the anti-treaty side obviously profoundly influenced the thinking of Liam Mellows, among others. And he actually, the Workers' Republic articles are part of what he quotes in his notes from Mountjoy. And obviously they thereafter frame a lot of left Republican thinking on the Civil War. But it's interesting that the Communists were starting from the point that a lot of workers weren't particularly driven by the treaty debate. A lot of Republicans tend to ignore this because they tend to assume that because the stake in the country people supported the treaty, that the poor automatically opposed it. And I think the stake in the country people certainly did support the treaty. From the very start, it's quite clear that they do. But among the poor, I think it's much more open to question. And again, problematically, when the Free State Army begins to recruit, what they begin to recruit in is, again, among the unskilled working class. Lots of working class Dubliners join the Free State Army. Lots of unskilled men in the garrison towns. Again, Republicans point out the type of men who'd have joined the British Army a few years before, but nevertheless, it's true that the Free State Army has a lot of these recruits. The Limerick IRA man, Mossy Hartnett, explained, they were paid the then generous wage of 25 shillings per week and their keep. It had a staggering impact on the poor, needy labourers and ex-British soldiers, all without money and work. So it was goodbye to republicanism, which most of them didn't understand anyway. Again, this is obviously his view, but nevertheless, these people are also members of the working class when we talk about that. Class conflict didn't end there. Goes on right throughout the Civil War, becomes even more bitter in many ways. There's a major strike of farm labourers in County Waterford and Tipperary. Farmers form a white guard to combat the strike. Special Infantry Corps of the Free State Army, I know John Dorney's writing a book on the Civil War, so he's gone into this. Special Infantry Corps essentially is a strike-breaking section of the army, and that's what it does. The new government also smashes a strike by postal workers, deploys the army against them. The Criminal Investigation Department, which Joe McGrath was involved in setting up, is also used during that strike. You've got JJ Walsh, a former postal clerk and union member himself, now Postmaster General in the Free State. He cynically points out during that strike that that union had never taken strike action under British rule, but they'd waited until there was an Irish government before they tried to disrupt it. So it's all rhetoric, but nevertheless. And at the same time, Free State Labour is more or less the official opposition. They're in Leinster House and Republicans hate them. As Emmett O'Connor points out, the more Thomas Johnson denounced the Free State's policy of executions, the more Republicans became abusive of him and his English background, which was always became very significant. By 1924, Labour in Dublin had its own civil war with the return of Larrikin and the split in the transport union. Membership in the rural towns and countryside contracted. In some ways, the last element of that was the fact that Labour TDs were elected in a lot of rural constituencies for decades afterwards. And sometimes these were people who had a direct link to that period. But union membership itself began to decline. And Labour does badly in the 1923 election at the end of the Civil War. Now, there's lots of what might have been. What I've tried to do is essentially say to a great extent what happened and argue for taking a broad view of both Labour and the working class. And hopefully in the next few years of commemorations, we do talk about those aspects as well. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please visit our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. Follow us on Twitter at Irish History Pod, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. And we really appreciate all the support from all the people who are listening. If you want to share any of the episodes with your friends on social media, Facebook, Twitter, anything like that, we really appreciate it too. Thank you.